Welcome to IG Connections, connecting IG clinicians with the information they need to know. I'm your host, Rachel Coletta. Before we get started with today's episode, we at IGNS would like to express our gratitude and appreciation for all the healthcare heroes committed to patient care during these unprecedented times. We hope this broadcast finds you and your families well. Throughout this pandemic, IGNS has worked diligently to provide clinicians with the resources needed to make sound clinical decisions for your patients and yourselves. We have made available for free digital copies of the Standards of Practice for IG Therapy, COVID-19 resource guides for both clinicians and patients, as well as a variety of webinars. And you can find all of this material at the IGNS website. In today's episode, we're going to discuss the recently updated COVID-19 resource guide for clinicians. Let me introduce you to our panel of experts for today's conversation. First, we have Dr. Ken Paris, who's the Director of Allergy and Immunology at the Children's Hospital of New Orleans. We have Amy Clark, who's the Associate Vice President at Diplomat Specialty Infusion Group. And we have Dr. Ethan Nguyen, Clinical Pharmacist and Vice President of Clinical Operations at Sphinx Strategies, an innovative solutions company for specialty pharmacies. Welcome, everyone, and thank you so much for your time today. This has been a really different world that we're living in. We've had to make so many changes in the way we live our lives, both personally and professionally. But the healthcare system has shown itself to be resilient, innovative, and flexible in order to care for the needs of patients during this time. So let's start there. Since the onset of this pandemic, how have you seen your practice change? And I'd like to start with Ken.
Sure. So, you know, before this all happened, you know, between late February and early March, and when everyone was instructed to stay at home, we at our practice did all of our visits in person. We went from having absolutely no experience with telemedicine in our specific clinics in the immunology world to doing about 95 or maybe more percent of our patient care via telemedicine. And we did that by standing up clinics within about 2 weeks after the stay-at-home order. We had to develop specific schedules for our office staff, you know, for new patients and for follow-ups. So it was a really big change within a very short period of time.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So what are your feelings about telehealth? What are some of the pros and cons that you've seen since being kind of thrown into this world of telehealth?
Yeah, so I think there are some pros to telehealth compared to in-person visits. You know, for our patients right now, it's a sense of security and safety. Some people are still very concerned about going out of their house for an in-person visit. So having the ability to do that visit via telemedicine seems to be really important for them. It can be really convenient. People don't have to, you know, dedicate large amounts of time for travel to and from an office visit. It can be really a perfect way to check in too, for patients who might just need a routine visit to see how things are going. It overall can be very convenient for the patient, but you know, there are some cons, of course. From a physician standpoint, I can't do a physical exam. So if patients have complaints that would require me to do an exam, it's very difficult, if not impossible, for a lot of our patients. And the other problem is that we lose the social cues that occur during a conversation between a physician or a nurse and a patient. We don't realize how important those are until they're missing.
Yeah, absolutely. How do you ensure that you're remaining connected to your patients while you're doing these telehealth visits?
Yeah, so that's been difficult. Some of our patients, connecting to the platform that we're using for our telehealth is sometimes a problem. We've had to develop workflows in clinic where our nurse or our office coordinator contacts patients before the visit to schedule. And then on the day of the visit, either our nurse or office coordinator will call our patient will do a lot of the paperwork virtually and then walk the patient through the connection to the video and try to make it as seamless as possible. And we've had some good luck with that. There's been very few times where we were unable to complete the visit, if any. And patients seem to really learn quickly and are able to adapt to this new style of medicine.
Yeah, Amy, I think you've had some experiences with getting telehealth up and running in your organization. Do you want to speak to this?
Well, we're certainly learning as we go. We've always been an organization in home infusion pharmacy where we've done hands-on teaching, in-person teaching, also to ensure that the patient's tolerating the therapy well. So this has become a brave new world, if you will. We, of course, recognize that patients want to minimize exposure. So we've had to look at how do we approach that. Is it a single subcutaneous IG visit in person with a nurse, trying to identify if they're going to be capable of learning virtually? Is it a patient that is coming to us from another pharmacy that may have a skill set where we just need to feel comfortable with that? So we are looking at it. I think that the biggest thing that we're going to discover is there's a lot we can do virtually, and there's a lot that we may not be able to do. So we're going to have to look at how we incorporate what we can do well and maybe modify or come up with a new mousetrap for the things that we don't or that it just isn't suited for.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ethan, from a pharmacist perspective, what have you seen? Are you utilizing telehealth at your organization as well?
Among the pharmacies that we work with, some of them already have telehealth or have been using it. And what I've noticed is that if there wasn't a great uptake in terms of patients utilizing that tool, or at least that interface, it is definitely being highly utilized now, especially with all the social distancing and shelter at home activities. And I think really what we've been helping the pharmacies understand is they have to get used to that transition and build some of that infrastructure, because even after this pandemic is over, I think telehealth is here to stay. So if they haven't been utilizing it as much before, and they're definitely utilizing it now, it's going to be even that much more important afterwards. So I think making sure that their team and their staff are updating their policies and their procedures, making sure that they understand all the nuances of how to utilize this telehealth, and then obviously making sure that the patients are getting more comfortable, understanding that this is completely available to them and will remain available to them even after the pandemic is over.
Yeah, I definitely don't think telehealth is going anywhere, and I do really think there are benefits to it, and it's something that can be incorporated into practice even when this is over. So Ken, how do you see the practice of medicine changing when we're through this pandemic?
It's certainly going to change, much like Ethan said. I think, you know, we've learned some things in the last month or so, and we realize that it's never going to go back the way it was before March, right? There may be an increased use of telemedicine in everyone's clinic, and I fully expect that a proportion of my practice will be using telemedicine, and we're planning for that right now. In May and June, we expect for people to be able to come to clinic, but I'm going to have a weekly virtual clinic for my patients that request that, right? There's some patients who would probably benefit even more from a virtual visit than an in-person visit. It might be quicker, more convenient, and we might be able to service them in a better way. And in person.
Yeah, agreed.
You know.
So let's move on. As we know, shortages in the use of PPE has been an ongoing issue for healthcare professionals basically since this whole thing started. Amy, can you talk a little bit about what you've seen in your organization? Talk a little bit about what the guidance is, and have there been any updates in guidance as far as PPE goes?
Let's kind of talk backwards about masks in particular. The most recent guidelines that came out from the CDC and through our current White House administration is that people, it's suggested or encouraged that people wear homemade cloth masks to save those surgical and N95 respirator masks for the healthcare workers and the frontline workers that need them. That being said, those homemade cloth masks are not considered to be protective equipment. However, we know that it can protect others from, for instance, if I have a cough, it's going to protect them from my droplet and my spray. The degree of protection depends on the type of material that we've used for it, and 100% cotton has been demonstrated to be the most breathable and protective. So you may not be a seamstress, but you can go to use cloth face coverings to help slow the spread of coronavirus or COVID-19. It's a CDC website. There are three options, one for sewers and two for not. So I would highly suggest looking on that CDC website. But we also now expect that if I'm wearing a mask to protect the people around me when I'm going outside of my home, then I would expect that a nurse that is going into a patient's home to be masking, and I would expect that patient to be doing the same thing to protect the nurse. So we are looking at those guidelines to use surgical masks during a patient encounter, because many of our patients are seen for greater than 4 hours for things like IVIG infusions. So it's really important that both parties are protecting one another when they're within 6 feet of one another. That being said, surgical masks are only offer protection to the person on the other side of the mask for the most part, since it's not a tight seal, but it can block some of those respiratory secretions if you're coughing or sneezing. And we encourage that nurses swap them out every 2 or so hours or when they're moist and change into a brand new mask. Mm-hmm. And then finally, I think N95s are very misunderstood. Fortunately, I think the media shows everybody in N95s, and patients don't understand what they're used for. And I think nurses who have never needed to use them don't truly understand what they're for. N95 respirator masks need to be fitted, meaning it's a process that you go to make sure you can't taste a glucose solution. There's a qualitative and a quantitative test that can be done. And unless it has been fit tested for the product or the brand that you're actually wearing, it really doesn't have any more protection than a surgical mask. So you can wear an N95, but again, it is to protect you from people on the other side of the mask, as opposed mm-hmm. to surgical masks protecting people on the other side. N95s, of course, have been a huge challenge. I think in frontline settings like acute care and ICUs, because they're surrounded by that massive viral load, it's very important for people to have access to those. In my situation, we're screening our patients to determine whether they're symptomatic, whether they've been exposed, and that helps us determine the PPE that we're needing to use. Mm-hmm. Of course, gowns are also in very short supply, so we've had to become creative and using things like disposable aprons and ponchos. We found a number of ways to make DIY face shields that can be wiped down and disinfected. So this is a very interesting time, but I think that we've risen to the challenge and made sure that nurses have what they need and understand what they're supposed to be using for the situation that they're in.
Absolutely. That was a great response. Ethan, do you have anything to add to the PPE conversation?
Yeah, I think in this whole effort, I think, for nurses and for pharmacies alike, I think there's an opportunity for all of us to help each other. So I do know that even though there is a perception that there's a shortage, it's more about accessibility. I think there are supplies out there. It's just a matter of who can get to it and who can find it. And I think if we all work together to make sure that if there is a need out there, if there are nurses or nursing companies or folks that don't have access to this, please feel free to reach out to all the counterparts, because I think there is supply out there. It's just a matter of finding it. And the reason I bring that up is I know that certain pharmacies do have, whether it's the N95s or surgical masks, and I've seen some of them extending and offering these supplies to the nurses that they're working with, just to make sure that everyone has access to PPE they need to in order to fulfill their duties. So I think it's just a collaborative effort to make sure that we become more resourceful in finding or being able to access the PPE that's out there. So as much as, you know, I hate to see any healthcare professional out there that's doing the good work to protect our patients and whatnot, and not be able to, you know, feel protected or safe because they don't have PPE.
Absolutely. That's an excellent point. Thank you for bringing that up. So Ethan, since the onset of this pandemic, there have been so many changes in the way pharmacies are run and pharmacy services are provided. So I want to kind of get into our guidance document a little bit, and I want to talk about what guidance we have provided for pharmacies and guidance also for infusion centers as well. So if you could just talk to some of those points.
Sure, yes. The guidance that IGNS provided is really clear, and I really appreciate the work that, you know, the organization has put to be able to provide this guidance. And really for infusion pharmacies, you know, whether it was COVID-19 or something else, I think most pharmacies should already have some sort of emergency planning policy in place. So it was a matter of the pharmacy executing that plan. And if they weren't very well prepared for it, this is a great learning opportunity, because I don't think, you know, episodes or crises like these are going to be, you know, one time in a long time, right? So, you know, there's already some anticipation that, you know, even after this subsides, there may be another maybe return of a COVID type of pandemic or outbreak mm-hmm. in the fall. So again, making sure that the pharmacies continue to reevaluate their emergency plans and make sure that if they weren't well executed this time around, now that they got time to really vet it out and put it in place, that they make sure this is a longstanding procedure that they can again activate when they need to. One of the things we pointed out in our guide is to make sure that the pharmacies are also evaluating and reaching out to their nursing counterpart, making sure that there's capacity. So, you know, if they're servicing a certain number of patients, making sure that the nurses that they're utilizing are still going to be available. And there might be some, you know, creativity about how they want to, you know, reevaluate how the schedules are being coordinated, what kind of procedures have to be in place, especially when we're talking about safety, right? You know, we mentioned earlier about PPE. We also want to make sure that the nurses and the pharmacies are coordinating so that these scheduled visits, if they're visiting patients, are planned out and that screening processes are in place. So all of that is really making sure that, again, we're updating our policies and procedures, because some of these things are new for the pharmacies to execute and coordinate. So as long as they're doing that, I think they'll be in a good position to continue to have uninterrupted service for their patients.
How about guidance for lab draws during this time?
Yes. So again, we're not saying that we can't fully operate during these times. It's more about making sure that we're being very efficient and smart about the need to be in close physical contact with patients or having nurses or pharmacists go out. So when it comes to a lab conservation, you're looking at, you know, is the lab frequency completely necessary? Are we having conversations with the providers, with the physicians, or what is the, you know, the timing or the window of need for that lab draw? Can you coordinate it so that you can have, maybe there's already a scheduled visit. Can you coordinate it so the lab draw is done at the same time? So really minimizing the frequency of having to go out to perform these labs is going to help with the whole entire effort.
Right, agreed. And honestly, these are practices that will, in the future, help optimize the use of nurses. And these are things that are going to be great to incorporate into future practice as well. So let's talk a little bit about infusion centers. What kind of guidance is out there and what kind of changes have they made in infusion centers?
Right. So again, for the infusion centers, they should already also have some sort of you know, emergency planning policy in place. And I think for infusion centers, since they're the ones that probably will have to anticipate changing a lot of how they operate in terms of continuing to maintain social distancing. And so maybe the capacity is diminished. You know, maybe they're going to operate at 50%. They're not going to take on as many patients at a time. Maybe they're going to space out the visit schedule. They're going to also look at, you know, logistically how they place the infusion chairs. You know, are we putting them at least 6 feet apart? You know, are the nurses provided the right PPE? Are they using the appropriate gowns and masks or even face shields. They also have to look at really how they're screening, right? So screening isn't done just one time, especially when you're having people come in. So you're obviously going to pre-screen, maybe like the conversation we had earlier, maybe using telehealth in some form or at least some sort of point of check. And then making sure that as the patients arrive to the infusion center, they can obviously make sure that you're giving them very specific times to arrive and let them understand that they may be sitting in their car until they're actually ready to be brought into the infusion center. So just more planful coordination, how we educate the patients of what are the new changes in terms of how they're going to come into the infusion center. And on the back end, really how the nurses are prepared to receive the patients. So with that, I think I almost forgot to add one more thing. The infusion center option is great. We also obviously have nurses that provide home infusions, but this could also be a great time to also consider maybe other alternative routes of administration. You know, if you're an IVIG patient, there are sub-Q therapies. Maybe if the patient is evaluated and they're capable of providing self-administration, maybe this is a time for them to consider that. So providing the training and the option is also a great idea.
Yeah, excellent point. Thank you for bringing that up. And Amy, can you talk a little bit about how providing infusion services in the home has changed since the beginning of this?
Well, Ethan stole some of my thunder. obviously, we are all screening and we're looking at CDC for guidance as well as the Department of Health in each state, which has a very specific set of questions that helps you determine whether you deter or defer that infusion or not. That being said, we are also having our nurses self-evaluate themselves daily to determine what their risks are and how we need to move forward. So deference can be the nurse that may not be able to see that patient and then having to determine either a replacement nurse or whether that visit should be deferred until that nurse is available again. The other thing to keep in mind is that many of our patients are immunocompromised in one sense or another, and you don't want to administer IVIG to a patient who has a subclinical or is presenting with symptoms of COVID without conferring with their physician. It's incredibly important that we don't trigger a hypersensitivity reaction or a phlogistic reaction, which is related to the inflammatory processes from an infection. So when we do identify that the patient has any of those positive questions answered in that screen that might indicate that they either have been exposed or have symptoms that lead us to believe that they may have COVID-19, we reach out to their prescriber to determine next steps before automatically assuming we can go ahead and infuse.
Yes. So talk a little bit about what a nursing visit looks like in the days of COVID-19. What are some guidances that you're giving to nurses and what are the instructions that the nurses are providing to patients during this time?
Sure. So very similar to how Ethan's ambulatory infusion suites work, 1 to 2 days before the infusion, we perform the screening questions telephonically. The day of the visit, we try and do that just outside the door to determine if the visit can go forward. Based on how the patient is presenting or the risks within the home, for instance, other people who may be positive for COVID or who have been suspected exposed to COVID, determine that we may have other people in the home remain in other rooms while the nurse is doing the infusion. Mm-hmm. We also ask that the patient mask, if at all possible, and if they're unable to do so, then we ask that the nurse wears a face shield in the event that the patient is symptomatic, i.e. coughing or sneezing. We certainly are doing a lot of education around wiping down surfaces and what hand washing looks like, how to cover a cough and sneeze effectively, and the importance of wearing a mask, particularly if they have family members that are going in and out of their home to go to places like grocery stores or go to places of business if they're essential workers.
Yeah, exactly. And just other things like asking nurses not to bring a lot of stuff into the house, only what's needed. How about disposable supplies like blood pressure cuffs and thermometers, or instructing patients to use their own materials if they have them at home?
Yeah, that could be a challenge for many organizations. Mm-hmm. If the patient isn't able to find a thermometer, for instance, because I know even organizations are not able to find thermometers in the numbers needed. So you do need to look at what that looks like. Is it using a baggie in order to, if you're out of probe covers, and then wiping down with an alcohol wipe very, very well, using blood pressure cuffs that are disposable, making sure that you're wiping down your stethoscope. You know, and again, if you're needing to bring in your complete nurse bag, making sure you're using barriers to sit on, barriers to place your bags on, you know, things that we've all been taught in nursing school that maybe haven't needed to use for a while.
Yeah, and I know patients have also a lot of anxiety about allowing a nurse into their home as well. So, you know, as the anxiety is going both ways for the nurse and for the patient. And it's just really important that everybody feels comfortable in these situations. As you said, some of these infusions can be 4, 6, 8 hours. So it's a different world, as I said earlier.
Yeah, and I think what I've told my nurses is that this is where nurses shine. We are educators, and that's one thing that if we do anything well here, it is to educate so that patients understand what's happening and why, and that they don't have misconceived notions or lack of education on certain things. For instance, how an N95 is used, since you know they may only be exposed to the news, and we can provide them with complete information.
Thanks. That's excellent. Thank you, Amy. And finally, I just kind of wanted to get a personal experience from each one of you, just something that has personally impacted you, whether it's what you've seen in your organization or something that you've experienced. Ken, can we start with you?
Sure. So, you know, I think this whole experience has been really eye-opening for every physician, you know, no matter what specialty you are. I think the thing that was most impactful for me occurred probably on one of the first days that we were doing our virtual or telemedicine clinic visits. You know, I hadn't realized how important those visits were for patients, both from a medical standpoint, but also from an emotional standpoint. They really appreciated that we were giving them the ability to be in communication with us in that new way. And the number of thank yous that I received that clinic day had exceeded, you know, what I usually get in a whole week. Patients were so appreciative and thanked us so many times for, you know, giving them the ability to be in contact with us. It was just amazing. And I just hadn't realized how important it was for them at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's something we can't talk enough about is mental health, and just maybe it's not a human touch, but it's a human voice and it's a face and it's somebody checking in on them and it's somebody caring about them. So that's extremely important.
Exactly. It's the emotional support, right? It's just so important, especially during this time where the stress level for everybody is just so high. It meant a lot.
How about you, Ethan?
Well, personally, I just have such a high sense of gratitude, you know, experiencing all the things I'm seeing, looking at all the collaborative efforts. And personally, I just appreciate so much all the little things that we probably take for granted in the past. Now that we're super aware of, you know, things that we need to do to protect people, right? You know, all the things that we're looking at in terms of how we're keeping our environment safe, all the screenings that we're doing, all the disinfecting that we're doing, all this extra PPE that we have to ensure that everyone has. And just a sense of gratitude that there are people, you know, working around the clock to help ensure that all of these things are happening. And like a little bit like Ken mentioned, definitely appreciate the fact that our patients more than ever, you know, especially in these times where they're almost self-isolated, right? They're sheltered at home, and there's almost a sense of information overload if they're watching the TV, if they're watching the media. And it's nice that they know they can always reach out to a nurse, a doctor, a pharmacist, and get the right information they need, and they have someone that's willing to listen to them and help them. So I think it's really, like Amy mentioned, it's a time for all healthcare professionals to really shine. If they haven't sensed all the great work that we're capable of, all the things that we're able to do and provide for them, I think they really fully appreciate it now, especially now that you know, we have to be able to find other ways of communicating and engaging and ensure that we're able to continue to stay connected. So I think that's really what I've seen that will come out of this and continue afterwards.
Well said. Thank you, Ethan. And Amy?
I think from the very beginning, I think everybody was, as this became real, I think everybody had a sense of fear and a sense of not knowing what was happening next. So it really became important for me as a leader to be empathetic. And what empathy means is meeting the other person where they are. And I found that in my daily kind of COVID update for each day that I did for almost 4 weeks solid, it ended with, let me know how you're connecting. Let me know if you need to talk. And this is for my nurses because I knew that they were experiencing a very high level of anxiety. And the amount of responses that I got were people, my nurses would tell me how they connected with family over FaceTime, how they had dinner. One nurse said that she had Passover dinner and FaceTime and shared that with me. And I got a little teary because you don't get a chance very often to connect. And I think being forced to be virtual has made us find ways to do that, that hopefully we won't, walk away from.
Yeah, absolutely. And just reconnecting with people that you haven't talked to for a long time. I mean, just calling someone that you haven't talked to for 5 years, not to talk about COVID-19, to talk about that person and what's going on in their life. And I also think it's really important for us to kind of maintain conversations that are not just about what's going on around us every day. It's important as well. So looks like our time's coming to an end for today. And I really just want to thank you all for joining me. I think this was a really valuable and insightful conversation. Before we wrap up, I just want to take a minute to talk about the IGNS Plasma Donation Initiative, It's My Turn. As we all know, patients who receive these plasma protein therapies rely on a consistent flow of plasma so that they can receive their life-saving therapies. These therapies can only be made from human plasma, and plasma donations are needed now more than ever. Each one of us has it in us to give the gift of life through plasma donation. If you want more information about becoming a qualified donor, please visit pptaglobal.org and also check out the hashtag It's My Turn on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Thank you so much for joining us. Be safe, stay healthy, and we'll see you next time.